Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to The Political Party. Today's guest is Helen Lewis, staff writer for The Atlantic, formerly of The New Statesman and host of the fantastic BBC Sounds podcast, The New Gurus. I'll put a link to that and to all of Helen's work in the blurb. The podcast is amazing. It's exactly the sort of thing. If you're into, especially a little bit of Louis Theroux, but that really doesn't do it justice, but great stories, well told, and a real focus on effectively cults and what makes them and individuals, and but also there's something that's very sweet about some of the people involved. So it's just a brilliant, if you're looking, as I'm sure you often are, for just a highly bingeable podcast, then oh man, it's just great. So I hope there's more of it, because I could listen to that. I mean, it's just, the problem is with it, it's so good you just binge it. I listen to it in 2 days and then I'm like, well, okay, now I'm on the hunt for a new podcast again. But I guess that's life. But many of you will know Helen Lewis, of course, one of the best journalists in the country, a phenomenal writer from a centre-left perspective, and someone who has a very clear take on what's happened on the British left in the last few years, and also some really interesting stuff about the sex and gender debate. So this is wide-ranging, it's great, and also, if you're familiar with Helen, you'll know what a talented writer she is. It is not surprising. She's also a brilliant talker. And this is just an hour or a little bit more in the company of a highly articulate, very thoughtful person. And it's just so good engaging with people who can, you know, have done all the thinking and can talk about it in such a brilliant way. Before you have the treat of this interview, I can announce some future guests for the live shows. So the show is now booked until mid-April. And here is the full lineup until then. And oh boy, I mean, there's been a couple that have been close to being able to confirm, but haven't been able to. So now I can fully confirm the guests for the next 6 shows. On the 23rd of January, my guests are Emily Maitlis and John Sopel. That show has sold out. On Monday, the 6th of February, I can now announce that my guest is Ian Blackford, the former leader of the SNP in Westminster. Now, he led the SNP group in Westminster for 5 years, was obviously a staple of Prime Minister's Questions, a leading member of the independence movement, a close ally of Nicola Sturgeon. And if you follow politics, I'm sure you do if you listen to this podcast, you'll be aware that there have been some changes in the leadership of the Westminster group. So that will be, I mean, apart from anything else, I love talking to people who've done PMQs on the reg. Do you know what I mean? People who've done it all the time. Angus Robertson was a great guest. And anyone who's, I think, find it really interesting, particularly with the third parties, because then they get 2 questions, how they maximise the impact of that. And obviously, Prime Minister's Questions are a different thing without Ian Blackford there. And he's had a long career. And there's obviously so much to talk to him about. So that I'm really excited about. The Monday, the 6th of February, Ian Blackford. On Monday, the 20th of February, talking to PMQs, my guest is Keir Starmer. That show has now sold out. On Monday, the 6th of March, my guest is Eddie Izzard, who won't surprise you to hear. I mean, in the 90s. I mean, Dressed to Kill was probably the stand-up video that I watched more than any other. Such a gifted comedian. And, of course, Labour activist. And is currently, well, may well stand at the next election for the Labour Party, for Parliament. On Monday, the 20th of March, I can now reveal that my guest will be Krishnan Gurumurthy, one of the most gifted broadcasters in the country. A really funny guy. And that will be a very, very special night. So that's Monday, the 20th of March, with Krishnan Gurumurthy. And on Monday, the 3rd of April, my guest is the former leader of the Scottish Conservatives, Ruth Davidson. Ruth is one of the most charismatic politicians in the country. She's a former leader of the Scottish Tories. She's now in the House of Lords. She's always just such good fun and engages in such a brilliant way. But what an amazing run of guests. All different parties, all different perspectives. So book your tickets now. And obviously, these shows have started to sell out now, which is great. But it does mean book your tickets early because, yes, because it might sell out and then you don't get to see it. But always follow my Twitter feed at Matt Ford, and always check the NYMAX website where the political party tickets are, because sometimes they're announced there before they're announced on here, because obviously I put them up as soon as I can and then I let you know as soon as I can on the podcast. So hopefully I will see you at some of those. And now on with today's show with Helen Lewis, who is just such a gifted writer, a brilliant talker, and this is a real treat. Enjoy. Delighted to be joined by Helen Lewis, who many of you will know from The New Statesman, The Atlantic, maybe The Daily Mail, if people were a fan in the early days. You made your name really in the world of British left-wing journalism, I guess, at The New Statesman, and you hosted podcasts and wrote brilliant articles. And now you're at The Atlantic over in America. So why do you leave us? Why do you hate our way of life?
Well, I still am based in London, so I haven't left entirely. And I have essentially become The Atlantic's royal correspondent, which was not a job that I applied for or I wanted. But I had to accept that I do have an upsettingly... You know how like men feel about World War II? That's how I feel about royal history. I just know an exceptionally large amount of random trivia that is completely useless in my daily life about it. I still have one foot back in Britain. But I don't know, I wrote about Liz Truss being outlasted by the lettuce and stuff like that. But I'd like to give you my real confession, which is that I was very grateful after the period of Brexit and Corbyn to take a bit of a breather from writing about UK political journalism. It was not the most fun period to be a political journalist, shall we say.
You'll have to forgive me there. I thought you'd like move to America.
No.
Oh,
no,
great. No. So you do like us.
I do.
You do like your country of birth.
No, but I've been reporting in Florida over this winter, and I was reporting in New York last year. So I do get to spend quite a lot of time in the States, which is nice, because then you come home and you realise that Britain's problems, though very real, are sort of less grotesque and kind of insane than America's problems. They're just sort of a bit more homespun and parochial.
You've also done a phenomenal series on BBC Sounds called The New Gurus, which I really want to talk about in detail, because like everyone, you're always on the lookout for a new podcast that you just want to almost listen to every episode in a day. And I think it's the most bingeable podcast I've ever found in years. I was disappointed there were only about 8 episodes or something.
There's 8 half-hour episodes, which, you know, Matt, given that some of the length of some of the podcasts that I listen to, I know people who manage to do a single podcast episode that lasts longer than that.
It's so good. But just before we come on to that, then, how would it differ and how does it differ working for The Atlantic rather than working for The New Statesman?
Well, the NS was a very small team. It's since had a big expansion, actually, after I left. But it did always feel like it was amazing that we were producing this magazine that had such ambition, when it was like, I think I would describe it as like 12 of us in a shed. And the nicest thing about it, the reason that I joined it, as you say, from The Mail, where I'd been a sub-editor and on the features desk, was that I wanted to work somewhere that wasn't such a huge kind of juggernaut of bureaucracy, where, you know, The Mail, if you wanted to write a headline on a completely harmless piece about like dogs dressed up as Harry Potter characters, it would be the subject of like 3 hours of various men, all an extraordinarily large, going like dog warts, you know, like, and then sort of workshopping it. And I remember turning up at The New Statesman and just writing a headline on something, showing it to Jason, the editor, and he was like, oh yeah, that's quite good. Yeah, we'll do that. And I was like, but where are the 3 hours of like us arguing about this? And the same thing happened with setting up the podcast, which you mentioned with Stephen Bush. We just sort of did it. We bought a microphone and we sat in a room and we did it. So there was a great level of freedom to doing that. So that's what I loved about it. But the thing that's very luxurious about The Atlantic is, particularly doing print magazine journalism for them, is the luxury of time and resources. You know, it's a much bigger staff, and I'm a very small cog in that machine. I now don't have any editorial responsibilities. I do feel a bit like Kevin Spacey in American Beauty. You know, when he goes to apply to the faux McDonald's, he's like, I want the job with the least amount of responsibility possible. Yeah. That's my great pleasure at The Atlantic, is that I just roam around talking to people and reading things and writing stuff down, which is like the journalistic dream as far as I'm concerned.
So it's not just that you were kind of intellectually exhausted by Brexit and Corbyn. It was also just the style of journalism you wanted a break from. You wanted to do sort of pieces that you had more time to consider and spend time on.
Yeah, I think I felt that I was in danger, particularly with writing a weekly column, of beginning to repeat myself. And I think the worst thing about that Brexit period, when the legislation just got stuck, you will remember this well, right? And you just had all this stuff that seemed incredibly dramatic at the time, like, oh, it's a late night sitting. Oh my God, it's 1 a.m. Oh, you know, people are brawling in the division lobbies, which was all very high drama as it happened. And then you took a step back and you went, well, hang on a minute, what's actually changed here? And also the thing that became really dispiriting was the huge opportunity cost of it, in the sense that, and I think you're really seeing this now, all the things that didn't get addressed because Parliament was just grinding through this one huge topic for years, you know? I think, although, you know, obviously the COVID pandemic has hugely affected the NHS, for example, the fact that it had just been languishing all the way through that period cannot have helped it. You know, all of these prisons are in a ridiculously bad state. And, you know, there have been 9 billion different prisons ministers, justice ministers in the last kind of 5 years. All this other stuff just got completely neglected as far as I was concerned, because everyone was so obsessed with Brexit. And I found that really, really dispiriting.
So what year did you join the New Statesman?
2010, December 2010.
Wow. So
just after Gordon Brown left Downing Street. Yeah. So I only ever been a political journalist under a Conservative government, despite being now very elderly.
You're not elderly. You're 39.
I know, you're older than I am, right? So
I am, yeah, less than a year, but still, yeah. If you're elderly, I can't engage with
that. Geriatric millennials have just got to accept that, you know, we're middle-aged now. It's fine.
So you join in 2010. Labour had obviously lost. You got a coalition government. Ed Miliband's leading the Labour Party.
Yeah.
You know, around that time, people in Labour circles thought he was going to win the next election.
Did they, though? Because I remember the whole thing about the 35% strategy, and the feeling was how he could possibly, win the next election by just sort of squeaking over the line. And, you know, I just felt like there was still a lot of stuff that had to go through a kind of, like a sort of washing machine. It had to just go through the full cycle of people just reckoning with it, particularly over Iraq, tuition fees, you know, all this stuff. It was still a big deal then, that the fact that Ed Miliband hadn't been in Parliament and therefore hadn't had to be whipped and voted for the Iraq war. The party just needed to have that kind of argument amongst itself for a while and get through it. I felt it wasn't ready to come back into government, really. And it was dispiriting, really, because no one loved Ed Miliband, really. I don't think in the country, certainly, the polling bears that out, but within the party either, there wasn't a kind of great wave of enthusiasm. Whereas there actually genuinely was for Jeremy Corbyn. People really did feel, let's give proper being left wing and stop being apologetic about it a really good go. But because I wasn't someone who felt that particular enthusiasm, that made me feel even further alienated, because it was like a load of other people were having a massive party and you were standing in the kitchen going, it's a bit loud, isn't it?
and it's rubbish.
And I don't think anyone else, you know, I don't think the neighbours are going to like this, you know, but feeling like a real sort of party pooper, when other people were having the absolute time of their lives and they were really excited. And, you know, I think that's the function. I always think the function of journalism is to be the boy going, that emperor doesn't have any clothes on. So it's a feeling that you should get used to, not feeling an enthusiasm that other people feel and having to deal with the blowback of that. But that was a particularly harsh and horrible time, I think, because other people felt so excited and they didn't want other people to burst their bubble. And, you know, I felt compelled to say, I don't buy it. I don't think it's going to work. And I don't think enough people are going to like it.
Was that an issue internally at the New Statesman? Were some people there taken with Corbynism?
Yeah, I mean, there was a good, I would say, a healthy level of internal debate. But what Jason Cowley, the editor, did right from the start was said, we're a journalistic project. His kind of catchwords were always skeptical and plural, right? So we're not a Labour Party magazine. We are primarily an intellectual space where all of this stuff gets debated. So yeah, there were people who supported Corbyn on the staff and people who didn't. You didn't get a kind of veto of the fact that I'm the properly left-wing one, so my word should be law. And we had good, you know, we had the smarter people around that project write for us, like Paul Mason during that time. And I think there was lots of that project that was good and interesting, right? There was a real feeling that actually Miliband's Labour and had kind of conceded everything, and particularly under the economic policy under Ed Balls, had essentially conceded that the Tories were right on their fundamental analysis of the economy and where it should be. And so I always found John McDonnell the more interesting part of that project. Because not just because of his economic policies, but also because he was hungry and he really wanted it. He got up every morning and thought how he could usher in socialism. And I respect that, right? He was in politics for power, which is what politics is for. So there was an awful lot of energy. But yeah, we didn't have the kind of massive internal schisms that somewhere like the Guardian did, because from the very start, the law had been laid down. And the same thing the same thing is true of The Atlantic, which has writers, it has some people who are Republicans in it and some people who are very much on the kind of liberal left, some people who are in the contrarian space or whatever. But we were always have, from day one told that you're here to do journalism and here to... The thing they told me when I started The Atlantic, which I think is a very good way of framing this, is you should address the best version of your opponent's argument. And like if that law were enforced on Twitter, it would bring like so 90% of dunkings to an instant end, right? Where you just... what you actually have to do is take someone really seriously and then take your machete to their argument, right? Rather than picking nut picking, right? The version of cherry picking where you find the most bonkers exponent of a political theory and you look at them and you laugh at them.
That is a really good just rule for life, I think, and engaging with other people online or off. But with The New Statesman then, because the same applies to The Guardian, though you're right that it was more severe at The Guardian. But did the rise of Corbyn, also at the same time as the rise of some new media like Navarra and stuff like that, represent not just an existential threat to The New Statesman, but because it was a different medium, but also were they sort of grabbing part of their audience? We were going, actually, that's the harder, punkier stuff. We prefer that rather than, flicking through something that's out of date by the time you get it and maybe more timid than the sorts of things that Aaron Bastani or Owen Jones might say.
I'm sure there were readers like you who preferred a stronger ale. There were more people who were like, why is everybody suddenly so angry? And actually really appreciated that. But we had an enormous expansion of the website from sort of 2013 onwards. That's what I was involved with doing, including several redesigns. And then we moved to this idea of having a kind of all-in-one subscription, which was, I think, absolutely game-changing, because it means that you are kind of platform neutral in the sense that we would then commission stuff in the magazine, but we wouldn't be holding it back for online. You can sell it as a kind of a bundle and you support the product. So I think The New Statesman navigated that choppy period quite well. But also, I think that for all that they obviously delighted in using me as a punching bag, as I'm sure they did you, I think that alt-left media space was ultimately good and healthy. And it should have, one of the things that is a real problem, and I see this much more in America, is there is a whole hermetically sealed alt-right, and I mean that in the alternative sense, not necessarily in the kind of fascist sense, but alternative media ecosystem, which is like OANN News, Breitbart, Fox, The Daily Wire, The Daily Caller, Drudge, just an extraordinary plethora of, and then before we even get to like individual creators on channels like Rumble and Getter and Gab and all of this infrastructure that has been built over the last 10 years about online right-wing media that is outside the mainstream, is extraordinarily powerful. It has this incredible ability to create narratives and memes. It's where the fact that everybody will kind of say Hunter Biden's laptop, and that's sort of taken as, you don't need to know what was on Hunter Biden's laptop because Hunter Biden's laptop. Don't hear about Hunter Biden's laptop much in the mainstream media, do you? And the left could really, although it would make my job harder, could really do with developing not a parallel of that, because lots of that space is incredibly fact-averse, conspiracist, nasty, harasses people. But a much bigger, healthier left-wing media ecosystem would definitely make things easier for left-wing politicians. I felt this very strongly about Brexit. I always had this theory that David Cameron got completely blindsided by the fact that he was going into Brexit not as the leader of the Tory party, but as the leader of Remain. And he was like, well, where are my lovely headlines? Where is the default assumption that everything that I'm doing is great? And you talk to people on the left, like Gordon Brown and Alan Johnson, and they sort of felt the same way, that actually had that campaign been led by sort of mainstream Labour figures, new Labour figures, they would have gone into it with the assumption that everyone was trying to get them. They were never going to get any positive press from, the vast majority of the print media, and they kind of acted accordingly. Whereas I think it really did take Cameron and to a lesser extent Osborne by surprise that you hate me now. Like, why do you hate me now?
It's funny, I think in Craig Oliver's book, and maybe in the Tim Shipman book, they mention it, that there was an element of surprise not by them, but, you know, by Cameron and perhaps Osborne, that, oh, this is so much harder when the press aren't just immediately on side.
Yeah.
Which of course it is. You mentioned being a punch bag there for the hard left. I mean, did you go on a bit of a journey with it then? Because I imagine a lot of people who are into Corbynism probably would have been a fan of yours and would have read the New Statesman and stuff and the Guardian. Then it all started quite gently, and then this onion slowly unpeeled itself over a period of years. I mean, was there a point at which you effectively felt that you'd kicked the hornet's nest, or that people had figured out that actually you weren't a true believer?
Well, I feel annoyed about that, because I think I've got a suite of political opinions which I think are probably way to the left of most of Britain. But the thing that it did change, you know, I would happily jack up inheritance tax to, you know, levels unheard of. But, you know, the one thing that happened to me is I completely detached from the idea that I think I'd unconsciously carried around in my 20s, that being left wing was the same as being nice or being good. It was being a good person who cared about other people. And I care much less now. If you want to describe me as a centrist, someone tried to describe me as a conservative. I was like, I mean, if you want to describe me like that, you're just making yourself sound insane, you know? I'm just self-evidently not. But if that's fine, if in comparison to you I am conservative, then that's, I can't really worry about that. So I think it broke my kind of feeling of any remaining tribal affiliation. That plus writing about feminism, particularly writing about gender, you know, the feeling that you were part of a tribe. I am not. And I don't want to be. And I think it makes you a better journalist if everyone hates you.
Well,
sorry, it's true.
Well, everyone doesn't hate you, so does that mean you're a bad journalist?
No, but you know what I mean, though. Like, I would hate to be. I was at Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida, his inauguration the first week of January, and there was a guy from obviously one of these right wing channels, and he was wearing a waistcoat. He looked like a stage magician, which was very.
What is it with the sort of libertarian right? And over here, there's a sort of dandyishness.
Bow ties. You're like. Yeah. Anyway,
so
he was there in his waistcoat, and he was obviously live broadcasting to Rumble or whatever about the fact that, oh, I'm up here with the mainstream media, and like, oh, I hope they're all held to account for their crimes during COVID. And then all the way through DeSantis's speech, which everybody else from like local TV news and the Miami Herald and Tampa Bay Times and all this stuff, and me all just like noting down because we're there to be reporters. This guy was going, yeah, woo, and I was like, I how can I explain to you? I don't applaud politicians when they come on stage. You know, I do not part of the standing ovation. You sit there at Labour Party conference, Tory Party conference, everyone else is like doing their kind of Pravda thing, and you look stony faced because you're there to do a particular job. And I don't know, there's this really odd idea now on so much of social media that the best journalists are the sort of uncritical endorsers of politicians. No. Politicians have their job. I have my job. And they're two completely separate things.
But do you think it is tempting, isn't it, I think, for journalists who obviously have political opinions to then want to almost get swept up in it all and do it whatever they can. You know, they want the world to be a better place. This politician they think is going to deliver that. And they kind of want to lend their skills to that. But then obviously, once you've done that, you're effectively not a journalist. And how do you then go back?
Yeah, I mean, for me personally, I think it should be, if you leave journalism to go into politics, it should be one way, because I don't see how you can ever come back and then not see it. And I do think it has been really hard to deal with the fact that you know, Allegra Stratton went from ITV into Downing Street and then back out and now to Bloomberg, and she has to include these disclaimers, you know, sort of saying, by the way, you know, I worked for Downing Street and now my husband works for Downing Street. And on one level, amazing access. But on another level, it puts you in a profoundly difficult position. And so if I ever found a politician that if I ever found a politician that I liked enough to go and write the speeches, and then I'd think to myself, no, that will simply never happen. I'm not a believer like that. But if I did, then I think I would just feel like I've given it up and I'd have to go and do something else afterwards. Because how could anyone ever take you? I this makes me sound like a weird monk, but I feel like being a journalist is like a calling, like it's a role in society, right? It needs to exist, like doctors or lawyers. And you do that. You don't do other things. That's what you do. Yes. And the Americans are much more steadfast about this. So, for example, one of the things in The Atlantic is that you can't go to as a member, like a fundraising event or a political rally, you can't attend them. And this is quite controversial, but I'm completely in favour of that. I think if people see you, you know, at a Labour Party conference cheering someone on, they know that you're not, you know, you're there to advance those ideals. And like, that's a different job. That's a good job, but it's a completely different job to what I see myself as doing.
But you're absolutely right that a journalist has a specific function, and society requires that you dispatch. Now, obviously, it also attracts people who can dispatch that function with beautiful language and can make you change your mind. And I guess the creative side of it is also what drives you. But you're absolutely right. You can't, once you cross that line, and also for your own professional satisfaction, we all know how we feel about the credibility of those people that kind of call themselves a journalist, but actually campaign and are very open about it. And then get offended when people say, but you're a campaigner, not a journalist.
I just fundamentally don't want to read those people, because if you already, like, the worst possible thing you can be as a journalist is somebody where you already know what the conclusion is going to be at the start of the article. Or, yeah, I know, I've been thinking about this a lot. I also think that journalists shouldn't accept honours. So this is funny. This is very presumptuous, isn't it? This is like me deciding my Desert Island Discs, as if I'm ever going to get asked to go on Desert Island Discs. But I don't think you should. I don't think you should accept. I find that, you know, it's very funny to me, because my old editor, Paul Dacre, has obviously been desperate for a knighthood or a peerage, preferably, for 20 years now. But you are not part of the establishment. Your whole job is to be outside the establishment, being the one chucking bottles at it.
But just to play devil's advocate, what if it, you know, for services to journalism at the end of a career, the country, through the monarchy, through the honour system, through the imperfect system that we have, says, Helen, thank you so much for holding us to account. Here's a little badge.
You make it sound very appealing. Well, you can revisit this when I'm a massive hypocrite who is now Dame Helen Lewis. That's clearly, I think it's going to happen. The thing I think is true is I think being a working peer is really good. I think there's a rationale for taking a peerage if you want to go and be a legislator and bring your scrutiny, because the upper house does a lot of incredibly good work, because they, no one can sack them, right? They're kind of uncancellable.
Yeah.
And that means that they don't have to stand for election. So in its proper form, there are, but the House of Lords in its current form is just a pack of cronies. I mean, for a start, I feel it is mental that we still have 92 hereditary peers in.
Yes.
I think at the moment, every single one of them men. So well done. We have essentially got 10% of the seats in our upper house reserved for men. That's a very modern country.
But that means 90% aren't reserved for men, Helen. You know, this is actually huge progress.
Well, it's huge progress from like 1382. Yeah, I guess that's true. Or certainly like the rump parliament of 16, whenever. But, you know, and the fact that it's now stuffed with so many people, and you don't have to, I think you should only be in the House of Lords if you are there to work. It is not a gentleman's dining club. So it's not an organisation or institution I would want to be part of. So thanks, Matt. But do pass back to the Herald Extraordinary or whatever, that I won't be accepting that OBE.
But were you ever tempted to go into politics? Because obviously you've got very clear political ideas, you're very articulate, you're highly intelligent. You know, was there ever a point where you thought, oh, I'd go and work for a party or an individual, or even seek office yourself? Did that ever cross your mind?
No,
not once.
Not a single time. Not once, no. And I'll tell you why. I'm really...
lazy?
I'm really lazy, yes. That's actually it. I've always wanted to be a writer. I've always wanted to go places and look at things and write it down and share those ideas with someone else. I don't deal well with collective responsibility. If you look at, you know, having worked at the New Statesman, which was a small independent magazine, and now The Atlantic, I like not having to toe a kind of party line, you know, that restricts hugely what you have to say because of the corporate interests of the people who own it. So I don't think I would deal very well with that. And also, I just think, you know, I'm an atheist, for example, and I got divorced in slightly salubrious circumstances, which I've written about in the book. And I just thought, I don't have kids. So all of those stuff, the things that we are, I think people would be horrible about all of those things. And I'd sort of just rather not put myself through that, really.
Has any politician ever said, could you help us out, finesse a speech or just give us a bit of advice here or there? Or would you be interested?
No, not like that.
Oh,
Well, the
crikey.
thing is, I mean, okay, I'm sensing this has happened a lot to you. If you do you get asked this a lot?
Not really, no, but occasionally it's only a very informal and sort of friendly. It's never like, will you come and work for us?
Yeah, but like presumably they're all desperate for you to write jokes for them because all politicians are desperate to be funny.
Maybe they've got my old number or something, but I get
But
the occasional request, which I always turn down.
here's another example of my slight orneriness. Is that I've never been a member of the lobby, and I had a
Ooh.
chance to do that. So I said, I don't want to. It's a very different type of journalist. Now, there are people I know who do exceptionally well. So I'm friends, for example, with Sam Coates at Sky News, and he is an absolute bloodhound. That
Yes, he's
man
brilliant.
loves news, and he loves stories, and he loves lines, and he can remember every micro detail of everything that everyone has said before and how that the line has changed. And it is such an incredible skill. It's not one I particularly have or want to acquire, and so I don't deprecate what that what lobby journalism does. But I've never had I am I'm implicitly worried about what a double-edged sword that level of access to politicians has on you. And I think if you're in the lobby, then the boundary tends to be a lot more fluid, doesn't it? Because you're hanging around with politicians every day. You work in the same building. You know, you're traveling with them on the plane and stuff like that. And people get very excited. And I also think this is full of my incredibly alienating opinions. So let's hope that none of my friends who work in political journalism says, I find it a bit gauche when people are like, here's the photo of me outside Downing Street for my Twitter profile photo. Because it's like you sort of shouldn't let on that you find it all really exciting. And I know
Yes.
everybody spends all the politics running around going, oh my God, it's just like the West Wing. And that's true of spads as well as journalists, but you shouldn't be over. You should try and consciously work all the time on treating it like you're going to work in Morrison's. You know, you're just there to do a job. You're not there to cosplay being Josh Lyman, although in my head,
You
obviously
know,
I
I
am.
think if I was a politician and I saw that a journalist had that sort of profile picture, I'd think, well, that's someone I can impress by inviting them more often. You know, that you're basically telling them what they can do to butter you up a
Yeah.
little bit.
Yeah, I think that's true. And it's really hard because you go into that kind of journalism because you're incredibly good at making contacts and schmoozing people. So again, it's not something that, you know, and without being rude to the shadow cabinet, I love them all dearly as people. I'm sure they're all great. My idea of a banging Thursday night is not it's not hanging out with them. Wow, that's harsh, but
It is a bit. I mean, I think some members of the Shadow Cabinet would be good on a Thursday night.
no, I'm being massively
You've
overly
just
harsh. Some of
been
them are
rude for the
incredibly
sake.
smart, but yeah, exactly. I'm being gratuitously, pointlessly rude in a way that I'm objectively against. But you know what I mean? Like, I think you shouldn't go into journalism because you want to hang out with the cabinet. You should go into journalism because you want to write about what the cabinet does, and your relationships with them are professional. Like, I find it very weird when people go on holiday with politicians.
What,
I mean, I find it.
journalists?
If I've heard of that happening, yes.
I mean,
And
I
I find
must
it
have
very
been.
weird,
What
and
do
it's
you
a very
mean?
posh person thing, isn't it, about going on holiday with other people anyway? Like my family would never have gone on holiday with another family. That's just not my, you know, pretty solidly middle class family. It was just not a thing that we would ever have done or considered doing.
No, same. I mean, I've been on holiday with friends who aren't politicians.
Right, good.
I mean,
Good
the thought of going on
clarity.
holiday with a politician is like fills you with dread. It'd be like going on holiday with a teacher.
I
Of
know you
what? You
know.
don't want an authority figure there. You want to enjoy yourself.
I know. I remember hearing a story about someone, and I can't remember who it's about now, and they worked in a think tank, and their best man also worked in a think tank. And the best man's speech, they stood up and essentially gave a sort of speech about tax policy.
God.
And I sort of think that's when you've got, you know, lobby disease, I guess, and you need to go and sort of touch grass for a bit.
Equally, a lot of these people are very talented people and they produce a lot of high quality work. I'm
Some of my
sure.
best friends are political journalists. I've had to face that.
I
No, but I think the good ones among them entirely acknowledge the inherent risks of the profession, right? There's inherent risks. I mean, is it like, okay, here's a kind of thing that is an inherent risk to the position in journalism that I occupy, is when you see yourself and your kind of self-images as a contrarian, sometimes you argue yourself into like that this arguing that black is white and the sky is green, right? That's
Yes.
the inherent risk of the position that I occupy. You end up saying things that are spicy purely because they're spicy, not because they're true and need saying. So any bit of journalism has its inherent risks. I mean, I'm sure every profession has its inherent risks, and it's just a different one for them than it is for me. But heck, God knows enough contrarian journalists have gone mad that it's not like arguing that that's a problematic free way of approaching things.
No, 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 that happened before social media, but in a way. I mean, obviously, 2010 was kind of pre-social media. I mean, I guess Twitter then was just people posting cat videos and their dinner. But it was...
I think 2013 was when it all kicked off. Certainly yes. The feminism wars did in 2013 on Twitter. And that was initially that was about race rather than gender specifically. But that's when it all got quite... Yeah. And then you have this independence referendum in 2014, which is the first time I think you really see in Britain this kind of idea of running against the media, that bashing the BBC becomes an incredibly useful campaign tool in a way that hadn't quite been done before. And so it accelerates from there.
And you mentioned the feminism wars in 2013. I mean, I sort of feel quite ignorant about this. I didn't realise 2013 was like a landmark year in that regard. So what happened?
I think you just ended up with a lot of it was down to a singular event, which was Caitlin Moran's How to Be a Woman became massive, just huge. And, you know, and she became the kind of figurehead of this new wave of feminism. It was very, very digital. It was like because of the fourth wave. And there was suddenly lots of interest in commissioning around it in liberal publications. So lots of people getting their first shot at a job. You know, it was a high premium based on personal stories, which is something that we then saw throughout the 2010s in that kind of late blogging era, as you know, and if you were 20 and you wanted to get a commission, kind of writing about yourself and about feminism was an incredibly good way to do it. And so it was a kind of, you know, I wrote about this in Difficult Women, but I felt like it was a gold rush essentially. And so some of the people who were left out of that gold rush understandably thought the game was rigged in favor of white middle class privately educated, you know, women, and had some kind of concerns about it. And then you put that into the blender with the fact that they could express those opinions and the fact that other people could express those opinions in even more vivid and striking terms. And it was a recipe for everybody kind of having a big, big sort of civil war, basically.
And here we are 10 years later, and the conversations around the Gender Recognition Act, the difference between sex and gender, and all the multitudes of the layers of that debate. Are the camps from 2013 on sort of one side or the other when it comes to this debate? Or are they fractured?
Yeah, it's not a subject that I write about very much anymore. And there's a good reason for that, which is that I was writing about it when it was completely ignored and people just didn't know anything about it. And that meant that you had to write about it in one very particular way. You know, you had to explain the very, very basic principles that were kind of at stake. And so that's some of the stuff that I do. I date that really back to 2015 and the first Women and Equalities Inquiry under Maria Miller, in which she endorsed self-ID and said that anybody who had any questions about it was, quote unquote, a fake feminist. And now she herself has kind of gone, oh, actually, now I think about it. Now you mention it, there are some difficult policy things that we need to work through here. And you're like, yes, if only you had thought about this at the start, Maria Miller. Whereas the problem about writing about it now is that it is this radioactive subject with incredibly strong feelings on both sides, people feeling bruised from years of, on intimidation. And the rhetoric is incredibly high. So it's just a complete different challenge to write about it now. The thing that's interesting to me is that Corbynism got kind of redirected. So a lot of the energy from Corbynism after 2017 and to a greater extent 2019 got redirected into it. It, you know, it's quite easy to predict someone's opinions on self-ID by their opinions on Corbyn, which isn't naturally, given that I don't think Corbyn himself, he went to the Pink News Awards and he said, oh, my name's Jeremy Corbyn and my pronouns are he, him. But he was essentially this like 70-year-old and it wasn't his political issue at, you know, Nicaragua, he cares about like gender, self-ID. It's not really his bag. But, and John McDonnell met with some of the gender critical groups. So he was, again, the more thoughtful half of that partnership. But, you know, it was just a kind of place where some of that energy went after the Corbyn project was a bust, I think. So, yeah, I think people did end up on quite different sides than perhaps they would have expected. And perhaps they ended up there for reasons that are not entirely about the subject itself.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Obviously, this issue has been around a long time, and it's perhaps I didn't appreciate, certainly in terms of the trans issue and self-ID, actually how big a deal it had been really before the Scottish government introduced self-ID. And that really seems to have forced it to the top of the agenda. And you're right, you know, post-Corbyn, you had a whole load of activists who don't want to just stop being activists. You know, there's a whole load of issues throughout history, you know, that, I don't want to get into Israel-Palestine, but part of that is the anti-apartheid movement wants somewhere else to go. And often part of the problem is that people think that, oh, this is the same, so we move on to the next issue. And actually, the next issue isn't the same. It is different. And if you just try and apply...
I hadn't thought of it like that. That's really interesting that you get the same, yeah, energy about kind of colonialism and exploitation that goes on. That makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, I think the thing is that it's very hard now for people who only just started paying attention to make them understand what it was like to talk about the issue in 2014. You know, I consider myself to be an extremely normie, boring moderate who believes that ultimately we will find some compromise solutions and that, you know, trans women are women, trans men are men, but not in exactly the same way as somebody who's born biologically female. You know, lots of, without getting too Marxist about it, the basis of female oppression is female assumed or actual reproductive capacity, right? It's not like, you know, the women were oppressed in 1300 because they liked wearing pretty dresses. No, they were oppressed because they were the class that gave birth. And so there are always going to be tensions between identity and biology. But that said, you know, for those opinions, a representative from Stonewall wouldn't go on Women's Hour and be in the same studio as me. That was their no platform policy. And they ran that policy throughout the middle of the 2010s. And I think it's one of the most destructive things that a charity has ever done, because it said, basically, here's this huge legislative policy change that we want that entires it. It has a whole kind of metaphysics behind it. And you cannot discuss it. It is simply, you know, we will not tolerate any discussion of it. Anyone who does, by definition, is bigoted. And that flooded the whole scene with poison. It meant that people like me, you know, were persona non grata. I'm still persona non grata. And guess what? It was then a debate that attracted, you know, extremists on both sides who really were there to have a ruck or work out some traumas in their own lives, actually. Sometimes that's what I see in a lot of that. But I think that the passage of that bill in Scotland has been very poor. And to compare it to something else, I think it's very reminiscent of the hate crimes legislation up there, which was very poorly drafted and had this mad thing that if you said in the kind of something that was someone else thought was inflammatory in your own home, this was something that the government was going to be involved in, and they kind of had to roll back from that. So I think it speaks to really a larger failure of policy making and the policy development process in Scotland. And that is a result of the fact that, you know, there has been, it is a one party, functionally a one party state, and has now been for a very long time. The SNP's incredible electoral success has brought with it a suite of challenges, and that Scottish civil society is now kind of deformed around that, essentially. You know, in the same way that I'm sure people make that criticism about the long Tory dominance at Westminster. It's very funny now to see businesses suddenly going, oh, I hear the Labour Party is a thing. Maybe we should have a stand at Labour Party conference. You know, when you're in power for a long time, then lots of benefits accrue to you, and people listen to you and want to be close to you and want to lobby you and want to, you know, fund you and support you. You know, people are attracted to power like that.
And just thinking about how Stonewall effectively changed, and there's a great, talking of great documentary series, Stephen Nolan's series on BBC Sounds about Stonewall is another amazing, just immersive, great piece of journalism, which I'm sure you've listened to.
I have, and I have to say my actual favourite, Stephen Nolan trying to understand the concept of being cisgender is worth the price of press permission alone. But Thompson, his producer, who is an absolute demon who understands every nuance of the Equality Act and the interaction between the Gender Recognition Act and the Equality Act, is the true hero of that podcast, because it's a lot for people to kind of get their heads around. But you're right, there's a really funny thing. You know, I was on a panel at Labour Party conference in the early 2010s with Ruth, I was going to say Ruth Kelly, but I'm getting my Labour people mixed up. No, the former head of Stonewall. You know, so I was on a Stonewall. I was considered a kind of, you know, and I would have seen myself as a kind of person who would have been on a Stonewall panel. Versus last year when I wanted to do an event with Maureen Colhone, who's in my book, the first Labour lesbian MP, her daughter on the anniversary of her death. And we had that all set up with LGBT Labour. And then people heard that I was involved and that event got cancelled. because I'm not allowed to be platformed by LGBT Labour. You know, that is the evil. My views have remained exactly the same, and that's the transformation of that part of the Labour Party in left-wing politics.
And how does that make you feel as someone who is effectively moderate, considered, not out to cause offence, to be effectively labelled a transphobe?
Yeah, I mean, I hate it, obviously, and it's not a label I would embrace or feel proud of or anything, and I don't consider myself to be hateful or bigoted, and I'm sure everybody says that, but then people have to make up their own minds. And for me, the only reason I keep talking about it is I think it's profoundly sexist. I went through a list of the women whose careers had suffered, and it was a list of women. You know, there are a couple of high-profile, notable male exceptions, but they're people who are really, you know, very much committed to this, and this has been their full cause. Versus you get women who said one wrong thing or published one very low-key, non-inflammatory thing. So there has been, I do find it very hard to separate it out from a kind of wider backlash against feminism. And that's the only reason I really keep talking about it. I don't have any problem with making the gender recognition process more streamlined, which actually the Tory government did, right? They took away massively reduced the fee and tried to simplify the process. But they did say that we're still going to go through this quasi-medical bureaucratic process. And so that's the bit that makes me annoyed, because when I see some sexism happening, and I do in the way, the condescending way that women have been treated, then, and, you know, and the fact that it has become a sort of way of trying to shut women up when they're talking about their own biology, you know, when they're talking, if you're going to start talking about women giving birth and people say, oh, we can't, don't talk about that. That's not, we don't talk about that anymore. Then as much as that right-wing politician who said, I don't want to hear the word vagina, I'm going to say, look, I'm sorry, but you have to be allowed to say the word vagina, or how is feminism supposed to continue? Sorry, Matt, you've got me. I try not to go off on one. But
that's really interesting, because I think a lot of people are just so scared to engage with it for fear of being labelled a transphobe, or thinking, am I having transphobic? Or it just seems like such a minefield that they just think it's just easier to not even consider it, which obviously then leaves the field exclusively really to the sorts of people you're describing. But it has something else happened, and I guess we've sort of alluded to it, that post-Corbyn, a sort of engaged group of people then put their energies into other things, but also that reputable or previously reputable organisation effectively been taken over, and Stonewall went from being a kind of lauded organisation, a gay rights organisation that was effectively seen almost as not politically neutral but reputable, and has ended up in, you know, the place that it's in now. Amnesty International have ended up in a position where they're saying things about Ukraine that's just appalling. It seems in the last few years that effectively reputable houses have been taken over by militant activists, and that's having an effect on the public sphere.
I do think there have been cases where that's happened. So Simon Fanshawe, who's one of the founders of Stonewall, involved in setting up the LGB Alliance, his sort of diagnosis of what had happened was that after gay marriage, particularly the legislative road for LGB rights, had run out. There were things that still need to be done. You know, kids still get homophobically bullied in school, for example. Like, there was stuff that needed to be done. But in terms of a legislative program, that as a lobbying organization that you needed to do, that there wasn't a lot left. So what do? Do you pack up and go home? Well, no, you don't, do you? You find the next thing. And that's what's, you know, something similar has happened in the US. I mean, hopefully some of this is kind of coming back now, but there was an extraordinary article by the head of Planned Parenthood, you know, the reproductive rights charity, saying, oh, we're a racial justice organization now. You know, we don't want to be held back by quote unquote Karens. It's a very sexist term, Karens. Yeah. And you were like, okay, but there are some really good racial justice organizations already. So why don't you do the abortion rights thing? And of course, then what happens? You get the Dobbs decision this year, essentially overturning Roe versus Wade, overturning the constitutional right to an abortion. Lots of states immediately bringing very draconian laws about abortion. And where is the infrastructure to fight that? It's often its own self-flagellating crusade about whether or not it has to say pregnant people and atoning for its past crimes and the fact that Margaret Sanger was a eugenicist, and not doing the thing that people have paid their subs for it to do, which is fight to stop women dying, you know, because they've had a backstreet abortion, or 10-year-olds have had to bear their rapist baby. I think it's an appalling thing to have done. But it was a very hard thing to sort of oppose, because It was conflated with being the same as not being on board with racial justice. And you're like, no, but it's okay for people to have different roles in society. We don't all have to do everything badly. You can do one thing really well. And that's right. Like, I'm not sure why Amnesty, you know, it's Amnesty's position on sex work is essentially like pro-punter. And I, you know, my position on sex work is fairly close to the Nordic model, I would say. Like, I don't think you should ever, anyone who sells sex should never face criminalization, because people go through terrible economic hardship, and whatever you have to do to survive is, you know, is fine by me. But I'm not in, I don't think it's a world in which more people are buying sex is a good one. And like, why is that? Amnesty really thinks that? It thinks that German mega brothels are great and good and just a bit of excellent capitalist free market? Like, what is that about?
I mean,
you found another rant. It turns out.
Well,
you've
this is all my
hotspots today.
No, but this is why it's such an interesting debate, and I think some people, until they get into the details of it, actually probably haven't really thought about where they stand on it, and they might reach a different conclusion to where they would presume they were based on their sort of broad politics. But is another thing that's happened here that the mixture of politicians, some of whom value being effectively having the moral high ground over their opponents. So you could say that about the SNP, that what they always want to do is say, you know, Scotland is leading the way, and they use that sort of language around the Gender Recognition Act, that effectively we are morally better than specifically England. Like, that's part of the thing, is that we've done it better up here. Scotland welcomes refugees and trans people and everything. You know, that's part of their political identity, is that we are actually morally better. But for the Tories in Westminster, why then have they effectively gone down a similar road and not again not put the resistance up? Is it that this is more the civil service, that this is a sort of like round the back lobbying campaign? What explains a kind of conservative party of various different prime ministers all effectively allowing this stuff to happen in Tory England?
Well, I think I once said, you know that joke in it's Fawlty Towers, where they're like, the Americans, having been late to the last World War, are very keen on turning up early to the next one. I sort of felt a bit like that about the Conservative Party, that actually they, you know, having adopted, after the Labour did the kind of grunt work with civil partnerships and broke that through, to then, and I think David Cameron's formulation of, you know, I support gay marriage because I'm a Conservative, incredible piece of political positioning. They really loved it. They really loved the social issues and being in that right place. And I think they thought that was a natural continuation of it, as did I. And I think to some extent it is, right? The thing I will always say when we talk about this subject is that your life is objectively harder if you are transgender than if you're not. You know, it is a huge decision to make. You risk alienating your family, you risk getting harassed in the street. You have to go through this bureaucratic process. It is a tough, tough, tough thing to go to. There is a genuine complaint there. So I think there's a lot of that, you know, there is a lot of that agenda that I support. It's just, and I think in most circumstances, realistically, self-ID is fine. Like, if someone tells me their name, I will call them that name. That's just how life works. You know, I'm not going to kind of go, can I see your birth certificate and check you've always been called that? But, you know, the bits where I have problems are, for example, prison policy. It's just sports, child medicalization. Those are the three big ones for me. So I think that, you know, there was a sort of desire to do the victory lap of having done something. And I particularly thought that was true in the case of Maria Miller, who felt that the first line of her political obituary was going to be expenses cheap Maria Miller. And now she'd had this vision that she could be pioneering Women and Equalities Committee chair Maria Miller, you know, who ushered through this great piece of legislation. And I think you're exactly right. Like, the diagnosis of the SNP, particularly Nicola Sturgeon, you know, someone who's always said, I'm a feminist politician, and yet had this very awkward fact of the fact she had been the protege of Alex Salmond, a man who was then accused of being a sex pest. And in the course of that investigation, you know, was revealed to have some fairly, I don't know, what's the libel safe way of describing this, but unorthodox kind of approaches to communicating with his staff and this professional environment that was quite boozy and, you know, the boundaries were quite blurry. And, you know, and so she was facing all these questions of, did you not see this happening? Does not this make you feel uncomfortable at the time? And that's not a discussion that she particularly wants to have. Neither is the discussion she wants to have, but who are perhaps some of the most, you know, troubled people in a society? Well, I'd say homeless drug addicts. And the figures, particularly in places like Glasgow, for homelessness and drug addiction are appalling. Scotland's education figures are not great either. And, you know, and that was one of her flagship pledges. And so there's a lot of discussions about social issues that the SNP would absolutely rather not have. What they would much rather be having is the big fight with people outside the Scottish Parliament, where they can go, look at these horrible people trying to hold back as we once again try and push forward in Scotland on into the 21st century. So I think in politics, you always have to look at the fights that politicians want to have and the ones that they don't want to have. And I think this was a fight they very much wanted to have because they felt they were on the right side of history versus why are your deprivation statistics so appalling is not a fight that they wanted to have.
I mentioned it earlier, but your podcast, The New Gurus, is exceptional. And I hope we'll get another series of it. You cover various gurus in it. And I guess there's a political element to some of them. But were you tempted to do a series or an episode rather on effectively political gurus or political leaders?
That's an interesting question. I wasn't, because I wanted to do the alternatives to the mainstream, and it's and particularly one of the things I wanted to do was a BBC audience, which is a big broad mainstream audience. I wanted to convey how popular some of these spaces are. You know, like for me, crypto was a really big learning journey. I was aware of crypto, I was aware of the blockchain, I was aware that I had default prejudices against NFTs, which looked like the sort of Dutch tulip craze. But I was not aware just the huge amounts of money that were being involved, and the fact that crypto itself was undergirding all of this other stuff. So Boris Johnson, I think, booked to speak at a crypto conference in Singapore, I'm pretty sure with Dick Cheney, which is like two men I would definitely go to for financial advice. Absolutely. Nigel Farage speaks at Bitcoin conferences. You know, he used to be a sort of gold bug and now he's a kind of Bitcoin bug. So there is definitely an interaction with spaces that I'm talking about. But I wanted to give the audience on Radio 4 a kind of sense of here's all this stuff happening on the internet. And if you're not into it, it's almost completely invisible to you. And actually, the weird thing about crypto was in the course of that making of the series that Sam Bankman-Fried happened. And that really brought the kind of huge regulatory problems of crypto into the front of people's minds. But you know, there's crypto regulation legislation being mooted in the US that is kind of in process. But most people, it's where social media was 10 years ago. They're sort of aware it happens and people are quite critical about it. And other people say, if you're critical about it, you're a massive Luddite. But I think that's about the kind of, you know, what I think of as the kind of my parents' level of knowledge of it. And that's, you know, and so there is a kind of education about this stuff is happening, and it's not weird shit happening on the internet. It's stuff that intersects with your actual life.
But it's also, it's a great fun, funny series, and you engage with people in such an honest way. You're not taking the mick out of them. You're engaging with them in a you know, an open-hearted way, and that really comes across. I mean, so many great episodes, taking the urine, the guy who drinks his weird and then basically admits that can't really prove it's any good for anything.
I love Will. I got off the, as I say in the episode, I got off the phone with him and I thought, what is not a lovely young man?
Yeah.
And that to me was an interesting thing to do because he's also an anti-vaxxer. And I wanted to understand what had got him to that place rather than just saying, you know, given that it is basically pointless to say to people who are anti-vaccination, well, you're wrong. Science says you're wrong. That's not going to, like, that wouldn't convince me if I held an opinion, someone asserting something. So it's kind of interesting to understand psychologically. And one of the things that came across in a lot of those anti-vax communities is about feelings of being sort of harmed by the medical system. And fundamentally, he had two complaints, which are true, which is one is that, you know, North American food is full of shit. Like it is.
Yeah, it is.
It's
yeah.
just stuff that you like, you know,
tastes good
like
though, doesn't
Rishi Sunak going on about how much he loves Mexican Coke. And it's like, because you can't put that stuff in it here. Yeah. You know, so the idea that food is slowly poisoning you, go down the aisles of a kind of, you know, American supermarket and think, what's in this ball of white stuff that's calling itself cheese? What is this? And, you know, and the fact that people go to doctors with psychological problems, in his case, you know, anxiety. But you could equally say the same about depression or about, you know, other kinds of maladaptive behaviours. And what they'd get when they need someone to listen to them and really talk them through it, what they get instead is a prescription. And so I wanted to kind of convey to people that those were genuine, real phenomena. And I could see how that then leads to a much wider disenchantment with the medical system. And so actually, that makes it all the more important to have really good, this is my normie policy wonk brain coming through, that makes it really important to have really good food regulation and also properly fund mental health services in your healthcare system, which is not, if someone said to you, how are you going to reduce vaccine hesitancy? That's not necessarily the two answers that they would come up with, but they are two, I think, quite useful answers.
Every episode, I was just thinking, this is my favourite. And then I'd listen to the next one. The Prophets of Doom one's great about people who think the world's going to end. Pickup artists. I mean, it's a great mix of different worlds of gurus. But in the end, when you wrap it all up, most gurus are men. And I can't remember what episode it is where, like, it's older men as well. And I couldn't... The reason I ask about politics is I kept thinking Corbyn was basically a sort of... You know, he fits the profile of kind of Netflix documentary cult leader, you know, even down to the beard, the sort of messianic element, the kind of that false modesty. You know, he's not that charismatic.
Can I say that? How glad we're putting this out on a podcast. Am I going to be testing to the absolute limits my theory that you can't get cancelled for anything you say on a podcast because people are too lazy to listen to it?
Well,
it but
I think people know what I mean. I'm not saying that. But you know.
I know what you mean exactly. So there are there's a podcast that I found out after we launched the series. I was very worried they'd think I was ripping them off, but they haven't. They've been lovely to me. Called Decoding the Gurus. It's by two academics, an Australian guy called Matt Brown and a Northern Irishman in Japan called Chris Kavanagh. And they have what they call a gurometer. And so when they look at people, they started off looking at the intellectual dark web and they now look at people much more broadly. So they've looked at Russell Brand, Robin DiAngelo, some of the people I've covered in the series. And they score them for a couple of things. One of them is galaxy brainness, which is the idea that you have an amazing opinion on absolutely everything. And you that there's these truths that absolutely need to be told. And another one of the conspiracy theorists is, you know, conspiracy mongering is another one. But one of them that I think is really interesting is grievance mongering. So if you're this person who is not in the mainstream, is not being lauded, has not been given the due that you think you deserve, what's your explanation for that? And it's that someone is holding you back. And I think you saw that completely with Corbyn. I remember writing a piece at the time that said, why do his followers treat him like he's a bird with a broken wing? People were horrible about Theresa May, not least her own party, who savaged her relentlessly and repeatedly voting against her and then chucked her out unceremoniously. You know, when she was an uncharismatic but ultimately principled and hardworking person. But no one ever was treated Theresa May in that, like, how could they... All she wanted was to achieve a Brexit that meant Brexit, you know, that's what a red, white and blue Brexit. That's all she ever wanted. But people did talk about Corbyn in those terms, like all he's ever done throughout his entire political career is love people. And you're like, he put a wreath on the grave for some terrorists. Like, he advocates peace where peace means capitulating to a dictator. You know, this is not actually all softly gently. Like, I would, that was what always annoyed me about that project, right? Was it was all like, why can't we just get along? And you're like, how do you suggest we all just get along with Vladimir Putin?
Exactly.
Just, you know, or Bashar al-Assad, like, just help me out here. But he does fit a lot. If you go through and read their gurometer, then you will see that he does fit quite a few of them. He doesn't fit the one about kind of like grifting, like merchandise, although then what if you remember that was a high or low period for Labour Party merchandise, depending on your point of view. No one's Keir Starmer merchandise is anything like as iconic. And the only good Ed Miliband merchandise was the terrible controls on immigration mug, if you remember. He never sold a commemorative tiny Edstone, which I would have bought personally. I would have had one of them.
You know what? I want a part of the original. I would love to get... You know, you can buy bits of the Berlin Wall.
Yeah, or the True Cross. It's like a relic. But we're fairly certain now that they sort of took it in the dead of night somewhere and ground it down into dust, never to be seen again.
I heard it's in a rooftop cocktail bar in Kensington.
No, come on, we'd have seen it.
Yeah, but I think the people who go to those sorts of bars probably won't appreciate what's underneath their nose. But I genuinely, because I'd heard it would have been taken into the dead of night and ground down, but I'd also heard that it was in some rooftop bar.
Here's the thing that I was still the best thing I've ever said about. I think it was Chris Deering wrote it was the heaviest suicide note in history.
Oh, that's brilliant. Oh, that's which so is good.
A joke that only works to people who know Michael Foot's 1983 yes. Labour Manifesto, which is obviously therefore somewhat of a... And I feel like you might be one of them.
And Gerald Kaufman's analysis of it. I've just remembered that you met Jordan... I mean, that's great when you talk about Jordan Peterson on the podcast. And I didn't realise that you'd interviewed him and that had gone viral and everything. I mean... He's obviously
You live a very sheltered life, Matt. You've managed to avoid these terrible internet controversies. What are you doing? Are you like learning Sanskrit or the like bagpipes or something? What are you doing with your time that's much more productive than being on
football.
The internet arguing with people?
Watching football. Well, I still get on the internet. Well, I get more argued at than argued with, really. I try not to engage now with negative forces on the internet. But because he's someone that I know, there was a period of time where some mates of mine would go, oh, you've got to read Jordan Peterson. And you go, okay, this is interesting. I remember the Cathy Newman interview, and you go, okay, this is clearly someone who is bright and can structure an argument and can sort of almost, not Hitchens, but like when you're watching a great debater, even if you disagree with them, you're like, okay, the guy's got skills. And then obviously, in time, in a way, his stock has waned, certainly amongst progressives. But is he, what's his deal, do you think? I mean, is it all just a mirage, or is there something sort of quality there?
I think when he started, there was a kind of, he fitted a very good niche. So, you know, Russell Brand fits a niche, which is one that we know exists, right? Which is what people call kind of crunchy left-wing populism. So it's like, as in crunchy, as in granola. So it is the kind of hippie chemtrails. The 9/11 did that, you know, is that, you know, like all of that, you can see the person that I'm describing, right?
Yes,
and
absolutely.
Jordan Peterson fitted a stern dad who tells you to take some responsibility for your life and you can achieve stuff, but you've just got to kind of pull yourself up by your bootstraps. That was the niche that he filled, and he did it really well. Like 12 Rules for Life, it's got some wacky stuff in it, but it's like The Lobsters being my primary thing, you know, some strange invocations of biology, but quite a lot of it's quite sweet. There's a bit about, you know, one of the rules is like always pet a cat when you see one in the street, which is just like, what kind of monster could object to that? You know, never interrupt kids when they're skateboarding. I hadn't planned to, but thank you. So, you know, that was, there was a lot of that. And I went to one of his live shows, and there was a kind of hunger for people just to be told. Like, I wrote a long piece in The Atlantic about whatever happened to Jordan Peterson. And the first question that he was asked at the live show, I think, or second question, was how do you get a baby to sleep? So there was just, he was just connecting with a very normie audience who were just like, I'm very tired. I haven't had a full night's sleep now for 8 months. You know, just tell me what to do. Tell me it's going to be okay. Having a sort of authority figure say that. But I think the reason that he's so popular, there's a great Slate Star Codex blog about why it's edge cases that always go viral. You know, it's never the sort of slam dunk bad thing that goes viral. It's always the kind of one that's arguable because people can argue two sides of it. And I was just mentioning it this morning to someone who asked me about why are people talking so much more about Prince Harry than Andrew Tate. And I said, so Andrew Tate, the former kickboxer, Big Brother contestant, now arrested in Romania on trafficking and rape charges. I said, in the liberal press, the mainstream media, people say Andrew Tate, misogynist, been arrested, bad bloke. And no one pops up really to go, ah, poor old Andrew Tate though, has he been overly misrepresented? Whereas Prince Harry, half the people think he's speaking amazing truths about the press and, you know, the royal family, and half people think, what a traitor to our beloved queen, how could he ruin her final months? So because there's an argument there, there's an engine that means that there will be constant engagement and content. And that, I think, was the engine that happened to Jordan Peterson. Half the people who read the books saw one version of him, which was this kind of sort of stern dad. And then people who saw his online presence, which was much more combative, would say, you're getting him all wrong. But the book people would have their version of it and say, you're getting him all wrong. And that was the polarization that happened about him, which made him so popular, I think.
So why are most gurus men?
Yeah, I've been trying to work this one out. And I've got various unscientific theories. And one of them is that either by biological predisposition or by socialization, men just, okay, what's the, I know you're not going to be offended by this, I'm going to say it, sort of like the sound of their own voices more.
I've got no idea what you're on about, Helen, and I often think this to myself when I have my moments alone.
You know what I mean? Yeah, but like, so I'm, you know, when I've been doing interviews for this around the series, it's like, how many men have got a podcast? God almighty, is this something like, is this something you get?
You realize you're on
now?
A man's podcast right now.
I know. Some of my best friends are men with podcasts, but like, but it's kind of extraordinary to me that, you know, and actually the podcast economy is a huge part of what we're talking about, right? Because you can have, it is a constantly circulating ecosystem where you, not that you don't have to do any work, but like you can ask someone to be on your podcast for free, right? So you actually get much, if I asked, you know, Sam Harris to write me a 2,000 word article, he's not going to do that. It's like a huge commitment to ask. But if you ask him to be on your podcast for an hour, you might potentially get him. So a lot of this does rely on a podcast economy. So it relies on people who are very verbally fluent and very happy to hold forth, perhaps sometimes on subjects with which they're not truly acquainted. And there's brilliant polling on this. Like, do you see that great polling that came out? Not only is there a great polling, that men are much more likely to report being able to, like, fight off a bear. You know, like, they ask you what kind of size of animal you think you could take on in a fight. And there are men who genuinely think they could beat a wolf in hand-to-hand combat. Like, no, mate, you're going down. Okay. You could be, even a goose probably could cause you some serious grubs.
Geese are petrifying animals.
Right. Very scary. Very scary. I wouldn't try and deck a goose. I mean,
no. Maybe I'm an outlier then, because I wouldn't fancy my chances against.
No, I mean, it's only about 10% of men, but nonetheless, it's 10% more men than could actually fight a goose.
Yeah.
And then the same thing happens when they do surveys where they ask people what they think of a cabinet minister, and they give a name and it's a fictional name. And I think it's something like a 15-point difference that men are like, doing a great job, because they won't say,
I don't know.
Because and again, that might be biological, that might be socialization, that it's more humiliating. They don't want to lose face. That's more important to men. We also know that, you know, there's research about the fact that in mixed sex schools, boys take up more of teachers' time, they're more likely to put their hand up, they're more likely to kind of hold the floor. You know, some of this I don't have a great deal of insight to, because I'm a woman who loves the sound of her own voice. So I am a gender nonconformist in that sense. But it was very noticeable to me. But also, if you accept the thesis that to some extent some of these people are filling a void left by traditional religion, then it wouldn't be surprised that all your authority figures are men. And also, they're really sweet gigs, a lot of them, right? So again, you wouldn't be surprised that, you know, there's a great research about the fact that if women enter a profession, its prestige falls and its wages fall. So, like, computer programmers is the classic example everyone talks about. That happens in reverse. They used to be women, and then they become, you know, like the way that chefs are very high status, but cooks are not. You know, the things we think of as female become low status. And so I think that is part of it too. And the one place that you do see lots of female gurus is wellness, spirituality, yogi. Because that's diet and exercise. That's kind of, you know, or like sort of, in a way, Mrs. Hinch is kind of a guru, you know, the sort of domestic guru, how to clean your taps and all that sort of stuff. That is, I think there's a thing that both that's a sort of safe domain for women to claim authority in. And also, does a guy want to be the king of clean taps? Like, maybe there's just not a great competition. Whereas being the king of crypto or being the king of dating advice or being the, you know, or any of that things are sort of more appealing, prestigious roles to take. But yeah, men do hog prestigious roles, and lots of these are very well rewarded prestigious roles, for all that they come with lots of sort of psychological downsides, particularly.
Okay, so this is completely unscientific and off the top of my head, but is the reason more gurus are men just a reflection of historic sexism, and that in time the guru sphere will achieve gender parity?
The girly sphere, yes.
Maybe. Is it also something to do with absent fathers, and that people are more likely to look for a father figure than a mother figure? Because,
do you know what? I don't think that is ridiculous, because for two reasons. One is that people sort of kind of explicitly say that. You know, I asked David Fuller, who is the subject of episode 5, who left his job at Channel 4 News because he was so excited by the work of Jordan Peterson. You know, and I said to him, do you see him as a kind of father figure? And he said, you know, I've asked myself that, you know, and John P says, we're not even transparent completely to ourselves. It's not like, he didn't think it was a kind of ridiculous or offensive question. And there was lots of that, I think, in the Peterson fandom. You would see quite sweet things in the Reddit Peterson forum that were like people posting, you know, here's my chart of the fact that I've got up every day and I've tidied my room and I've showered and, like, you know, here's my life goals. There's quite a lot of that kind of slightly sweet, earnest, young male sort of pathfinding that I think you find with a lot of the gurus, like kind of young men finding their way. So I think that's definitely part of it. And then also the fact is that so many of the things that I looked at were kind of undergirded by worries about masculinity. So the dating sphere is really interesting. I mentioned Andrew Tate earlier. We talked about a different guy called Tom Torero, but a lot of that was about kind of, you know, you've got to kind of bang as many chicks as you can, you know, and women have got all this choice because of feminism, you know, they don't have to settle. So you've got to be a kind of alpha. There's a lot of that stuff happens around the place. And a lot of anxiety and tension about what men's role is, which kind of comes out either in sort of sweet self-improvement ways or comes out in quite hostile anti-feminist ways about women have all had it too easy. You know, which you've seen things like the incel movement, for example. You know, this sort of resentment and entitlement. So I think there is something particularly about hashtag masculinity in crisis. But, you know, but that actually there is a lot of kind of men looking for men to take guidance from, you know, masculine authority figures and different versions of masculinity, right? Which I think is really interesting. There is the kind of the Liver King. I don't know if you're familiar with the Liver King.
No.
Absolutely jacked. And
oh, is he the guy who was outside Buckingham Palace not long ago?
I've lost your sound again, by the way. So we'll never know what you think about the Liver King. Let me finish the thought and then we can wrap it up. It's fine. And you know, he's this kind of, like, as in Clive James's famous description of Schwarzenegger, like a condom filled with walnuts. So that's one idea. And then there's the sort of slightly more sensitive alpha kind of vibe, which you do see kind of a lot, which is, and actually lots of kind of men who are quite lachrymose, which I find quite fascinating. At the same time that they're sort of preaching this strongman aesthetic, they themselves seem to be quite ooh-ooh small beans. So I think there is a kind of, yeah, there is a thread running through a lot of the series that is about kind of tension over masculinity.
Helen, I won't keep you any longer. I've kept you far longer than I promised I would. Thank you so much for doing this. Where can people find your podcasts and your writing?
So you can find The New Gurus on BBC Sounds or wherever you find your podcasts. You can find more of my writing at The Atlantic, and you can find the shell of my presence on Twitter, as I am trying not to tweet anymore, but things keep annoying me, so that resolve has been constantly tested. But yeah, thank you very much, Matt, for having me.
And will there be another series of Gurus?
I don't know if there'll be another series of Gurus. It depends on the BBC. Hopefully there'll be a repeat for it in March on radio, and maybe a bonus episode if we can get to them. But I just need a long lie down in a darkened room. Someone did say to me that you are basically taking on every kind of tight-knit anti-mainstream media community on the internet. Are you absolutely sure you want to do this? And I thought, I'm ready. I've been there before.
It's such a good series. I really hope that it doesn't just get a second to it. It should just be one of those things that's on every week on BBC Sounds. Thank you so much. Well, there you go, Helen Lewis. Not only should you read her fantastic writing for The Atlantic, but you have to listen to that Gurus podcast. It is just so addictive. It's absolutely brilliant. So that is another podcast for you to get. You can listen to all the episodes of it before the next episode of this. On this podcast, by the way, do leave a 5-star written review on iTunes or Apple Podcast, whatever it's called now, because it does help other people find it, or whatever platform you listen to. Do share it far and wide. Tell your friends. Tell your family, and don't forget to book tickets for the live shows early, because those guests are incredible. The 23rd of January, Emily Maitlis and John Sopel. The 6th of February, Ian Blackford. 20th of February, Keir Starmer. 6th of March, Eddie Izzard. 20th of March, Krishnan Gurumurthy. 3rd of April, Ruth Davidson. Guests for later in the year. And there are some treats to be announced, I can tell you now, will be announced in due course. Tickets for all the shows through to July are available to buy on the link that I will put in the blurb. Thank you so much for downloading this. Happy New Year. Is it too late? It's too late to backtrack it now, because I've said it. So Happy New Year. I think this is possibly the latest Happy New Year that you'll experience. Happy New Year. I hope you're enjoying the start of the year. January is a terrible month, so hopefully this podcast has helped perk you up for at least the last hour or so. And, I'm just going on now for no reason. I'll see you soon. Ta-ra.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.